includes scuba diving, parachuting, and being forcefully restrained. Of course, the former are a matter of choice, but not the latter. This was the first case for me, although soon others followed, in which a black patient died under restraint, and in whom I could find only a few sickle cells in the tissues when I looked down the microscope. This indicated that they did not have full sickle cell disease, but sickle cell trait, and this could then be confirmed by specialist tests on their hemoglobin. Sadly, many probably did not even know that they were carriers. This particular patient also showed signs of hypoxia, which is a lack of oxygen. He had been forcibly restrained, but none of his injuries was actually life-threatening. Clearly then, the police actions must have gone further than was indicated by the areas of bruising, all of which I noted carefully in my report. It was only later that I was given the full story. He was being held at a London jail, awaiting trial for conspiracy to defraud. I'm not sure what he did for his behaviour to be described by prison medical officers as strange, enough for them to arrange his transfer to the hospital wing of Brixton Jail. I think from that I would assume mental health problems, although none of the medical notes specifically said so. I didn't think that this behaviour was drug-related since, although cocaine was found in his urine, it was very minimal. During transportation to the hospital wing at Brixton, he became agitated or aggressive, then unresponsive. That description comes from notes taken by the doctor at the accident and emergency department when the patient was driven there later. According to the police's own records, on arrival at Brixton Prison's hospital wing, it was noticed that he appeared not to be breathing. So he was bundled into the back of a van and taken to A&E. He was given CPR on the way, but those resuscitation attempts were not successful. In fact, the A&E doctor's notes added, "fingers stiff." It seemed to me that he may have been held in a way that restricted his breathing and his oxygen supply, possibly face down, or maybe someone knelt on his chest. But the post-mortem showed that death was caused primarily by the fact that he had severe pneumonia. This was enough to slip him out of the suspicious death category. He had died from natural causes, a combination of pneumonia and sickle cell trait. Although I felt and said that he might have survived pneumonia if he'd been given proper treatment immediately and if he had not been restrained in a body belt face down or in some other position that further restricted his ability to breathe. The deceased was of no fixed abode and he may therefore have been living rough and contracted pneumonia before his arrest. Or he may actually have contracted it in custody. An inquest was held and a verdict of death by natural causes was given. Aggravated, the coroner said in something of an understatement, by lack of care. This took place less than 30 years ago, but in those days in general, and this is not true of all communities, the bulk of society thought criminals deserved what they got, and that the police were always, or at least usually, right. So even without the natural and mitigating factors of his sickle cell trait and pneumonia, there would have been no outcry at the death of a prisoner. And I'm sorry to say that, the times being what they were, such indifference was especially true if the prisoner was black. Indifference from both public and police meant there was an almost total lack of training and understanding about how and when to restrain someone safely. Such training was not considered relevant or useful for the day-to-day work of a policeman or prison officer. It was acceptable for staff simply to rugby tackle people, jump on them, wrestle with them, do whatever was necessary to get them under control. And control meant still. Police and prison officers were trusted to do what was right, and the nation was uncaring about the possibility that they might not. I, however, could not share this attitude. I saw a series of deaths in custody or under restraint. Many of the dead were black. This was not just a sickle cell problem, although it was sickle cell that had brought it to my attention. I felt that I had to do something, but what? I worked with a med, and good, supportive relations were essential at the scene of a crime and afterwards. I liked and respected many officers. A pleasant working relationship with them was essential to me, and so I did not know how to call them on their behaviour. But I knew I had to, and as the deaths under restraint were more than occasional, I realised that I had to focus on this. I just wasn't sure yet how to use my knowledge to improve the situation. After all, pathologists examine bodies and understand the cause of death. Our findings might contribute to the saving of future lives or the process of justice. But it wasn't my job to change the world, was it? Chapter 21. I could not ignore the problem of death caused by restraint, but intellectually and analytically, I remained committed to studying knife murders. As a bullets and bombs man, Ian West had specialized in a comparatively straightforward area. The perpetrators want someone dead, and they shoot them. End of story. Stab wounds require perpetrator and victim to be up close and personal. Stab wounds often involve mixed motives. Stab wounds may have more to do with a sense of theatre than a definite wish to kill, particularly if the injuries are self-inflicted. But what really interested me was my theory that every wound track tells a story. I was still sure that the exact track a knife made into the body, and often victims are stabbed many times, could provide a sort of photograph of the homicide itself if one knew enough about wounding. At each knife murder, I was anxious to learn anything I could from the wounds. Very soon after the suicide of the old man with the bread knife came another death by knife. It was an entirely routine homicide, but it did show me that all those experiments with a Sunday roast were getting me somewhere. Winter followed quickly behind that sunny autumn day, and soon the first frost came. One morning I was called to a body found by a canal in North London. I arrived at noon to find a young man in jeans and jacket, lying face down in a grassy waste area, his arms beneath him. The temperature was still only 2 degrees centigrade, and this did not help the usual problems determining the time of death. Body temperature was down to 20 degrees centigrade, and the police photographs show that there was frost still on the body when found. Rigor mortis was established, but not fully fixed. All I could tell the police from this was that death had occurred at some time between midnight and 6 a.m., eliciting the usual response of veiled frustration. The grass adjacent to the deceased's feet was bloodstained, and next to the body was a bloodstained kitchen knife. I turned him over and saw that the mouth, nose, hand and front of the chest were covered in blood. We moved him to the mortuary for a full post-mortem, where I confirmed that a single stab wound had penetrated first his clothes, then the cartilage of 3 adjacent ribs. The cartilage had deflected the blade. Just a little, but that small deflection meant, sadly, that the knife went straight into the aorta. It had cut through the aorta to the trachea behind it. The track ended in the esophagus. The total track length from the skin surface was 12 centimeters. The incision went horizontally from front to back and slightly from right to left. The black-handled kitchen knife found nearby would certainly have been the right size and shape to cause this wound. The force used must have been more than moderate, as it had cut through both clothing and the 3 ribs. There were also minor abrasions on the deceased's face and various abrasions on the left arm. It looked like a straightforward stabbing. The police were trying to match it to the defendant's story. The defendant and victim, both aged about 20, had been drinking together and then went out for a walk. They were good friends, but, as revealed during his police interview, the accused was secretly angry with his mate. Q. What did you talk about? A. Nothing really. Q. Were you armed? A. No. Q. Was he? A. Yeah, he always carries a knife. Q. On previous occasions, have you both carried knives? A. Yeah, but mine was at home then. Q. I must tell you that you are still under caution. Do you know how he died? A. I think I do. Q. Please tell us. A. We reached the canal and he said he felt sick. So I stood there and waited for him, and I looked down and saw my trainer was undone. So I bent down to retie my lace, and he said, "What do you think of me going out with your sister?" Q. Mary? A. Yes. Q. How old is Mary? A. 13. Q. What did you say? A. I said I didn't like it very much because she's only 13. I looked up to face him and ask him why he was asking, but I didn't have time. He was drawing something from his clothing. I thought he was going to hit me. So I panic and I push him. Then I turn and run. I turned round once and saw him stumbling backwards. I carried on running. I didn't know he was hurt, or I would have gone back and helped him. Further questioning revealed how upset the young man was at the possibility that his friend was having sex with the 13-year-old Mary. After one of many breaks, during which he conferred with his solicitor, the accused said, "If it's the knife I think it is, then I saw that in his flat. It had fallen out of the plate rack with a load of others, and I picked it up and put it on the worktop." The solicitor later asked once again for a few words alone with his client, who, on re-emerging, admitted to causing the death, but insisted it had been an accident. "He was my best friend, and no way did I mean to hurt him. That's it." I was sure that the defendant's version of events was false. My own instinct told me that it would not be possible to turn around a knife held by someone else and penetrate the chest with it in this way. The wound was straight and horizontal, and certainly not to penetrate so high into the chest from a low, crouching position. However, on the basis that the defendant was innocent until proven guilty, I tried reenacting the scene at home. I crouched on the floor, pretending to tie my shoelace with my right hand, look up, and deflect an assailant's approaching ruler, standing in for the knife, which I held in my left hand, into the assailant, a pillow on a chair, and cause a horizontal, straight wound. I had just got the ruler into the pillow when I realized that someone else was in the room. I turned around. Chris had come into the study. Both children had been taught to knock, so that they wouldn't stumble upon any upsetting material. I must have been so engrossed that I didn't hear him. Now he was staring at me rather awkwardly. "Yes," I said, trying to look as if this was all perfectly normal. He was clutching a school book. "What are you doing?" he asked in a voice which required some explanation. He was 9 now, and a relaxed, even-tempered child, who seemed in no way related to the screaming baby emperor who had tortured us for nights on end. I stood up. Honesty was probably the best policy. "Well, I'm trying to see if a man tying his shoelace, that's me here, with my right hand, if another man came at him with a knife, that's me too, the other man is my left hand and the ruler is the knife, if the first man could somehow turn the knife around and stick it into the second man, all while he's crouching down." Chris considered this wisely. "Yes," he said at last, "I think he could." "Thinking isn't good enough. The first man could be sent to prison for a long time, so I have to be sure." "Did the first man kill the second man?" "Well, yes." "Have you seen him?" "The first man?" "No." "The second man?" "Yes, Chris, I've seen him in the mortuary. I've examined his wounds, and I know that the knife went into him at a certain angle, in a certain way. I'm trying to see if the first man could have done that when he was attacked while he was tying his shoelace." Chris nodded. I was not sure he really comprehended what I was saying. He just accepted that his father did some strange things. "I came to show you my biology book. I got the highest mark of anyone. Of course, my son was here for a reason, and I had been so engrossed, I had told him about my work without even asking what that reason was. We looked at the biology book together, and I exclaimed with great parental pride over his run of A's, and eventually Chris left looking cheerful, and I continued my experiment. Despite trying very hard, I simply could not contrive a way for a crouching individual to deflect or push a knife held by an assailant into the assailant's chest. Not if the result was to be such a high, horizontal track into the pillow, I mean body. As I had strongly suspected, this case was a straightforward, in both senses, standing, stabbing, injury. There was a small knock at the study door. "Daddy, we both think he did it," said Anna, bursting in. "Who did what?" "Well, Chris was the first man tying his shoelace, and I was the second man coming at him with a knife, and you didn't use a real knife, did you?" "No, I used my pen. Anyway, Chris easily turned it round and stabbed me, so we think the first man is a murderer." "Right. Well, thanks. Shall we show you? Or if you like, you could be the first man and I'll be the second man. I'm better at this than Chris." I felt that Anna, who must only have been 7 years old, should not really be helping me reconstruct a homicide. If she ever caught me with a knife, she tended to regard it as a bit of a joke. She responded to the idea of dead bodies as something unsavory, but the full meaning of death was still lost on her, and she had certainly not seen a body, not even a photograph. Not only were the children taught to knock on the study door, I always carefully hid any police pictures on a high shelf. "Just what game are you playing with the children?" demanded Jen, appearing from the living room, her face thunderous. "No games. Chris came in, so I told him what I was doing." Jen rolled her eyes. "I leave my work at the hospital," she said pointedly. Chris and Anna eventually would understand fully what my job entailed. But for now, anyway, they were told simply to inform anyone who asked that I was a doctor. They had picked up the fact that I was a specific sort of doctor, that I helped the police and that my name appeared in the newspapers, but they had no real idea what a forensic pathologist was. Although around about this time, they began to realize that my speciality did not make people better. In our household, it was fairly normal for Dad to stick rulers and knives into pillows and pieces of meat, and, so far, Chris and Anna seemed not to have realized that other people's fathers didn't do that. Today, the defense team in that stabbing case by the canal might successfully offer a manslaughter plea of loss of self-control. A post-Saville jury might decide that seeing a red mist because your friend was sexually imperiling your 13-year-old sister is enough of a trigger. There were plenty of statements from family members that confirmed how upset and furious the brother had been at a possible abuse by his friend. For the modern defense of loss of self-control, it must be proved that a person of the defendant's age and sex, with a reasonable degree of tolerance and self-restraint, would lose control in a similar way. I think the young man would have had a good chance of showing that. But for loss of control, the defense must also prove that there was no premeditation. The pitfall for this defendant would be that the murder might have appeared premeditated if he had actually carried the knife to the canal that night. He had explained why his fingerprints were on the handle, but he would have had to persuade the jury that the victim had been the one to take the knife from the kitchen before they went out for their walk. This homicide happened long before the reforms of 2010 in less enlightened times. Loss of control was not a defense. There was then no hope for the young man who was so anxious to protect his sister. The charge was murder, and he was found guilty. An open and shut case in the 1980s. A routine murder, but one in which the precise angle and track of the stab wound provided important evidence. And it very often does. Not just the track, but once the knife is in the body, its subsequent movement inside an organ can sometimes chart the respective movements of victim and perpetrator. As my casebook thickened, I became increasingly convinced that knife wounds could tell all, if only we could hear what they were saying. I wanted to compile a really comprehensive analysis of tracks, angles, hilt bruises. I was always rooting around in the kitchen at home for another knife to stick into another piece of meat. In fact, I bought so many knives of different shapes and hilts that going home at night, had the police been in the habit of stopping and searching middle-class white men, I could frequently have been arrested for carrying offensive weapons. To the continued disgust of my family, I now use pork bellies or cow kidneys for my stabbing exercises. It was extremely hard to reproduce quite the feel of pushing through human skin, muscle, and then an internal organ, perhaps because supermarket meat is seldom fresh. In reality, people who have killed with a knife are usually astonished by how easy it is. Once the blade has cut through the clothing and the skin, the inner body tissues put up little resistance. Only moderate force is required to penetrate major organs like the heart or the liver. And so even perpetrators with little strength can kill by stabbing. A lot of murderers say, "I didn't mean to kill him." What they're actually saying is, "I didn't think that what I was doing would kill him." And this is more likely to be true when knife murderers say it than others. Knives gives the murderer an immense advantage over their victim, even if the victim is much stronger. No wonder women so often turn to them. And did I prove, after all these experiments, that it is possible to read the history of a murder by reading the stab wounds like a book, as I had hoped? Well, no. But I did find knives could tell a lot about a homicide. I developed the ability to sketch a murder weapon with some accuracy, based on the track it had left in the body. And when the police offer me a series of possible murder weapons, I can exclude most, and if the right one is presented to me, generally pick it out. Chapter 22. Just 8 months after the Clapham Rail disaster, I took a call early one Sunday morning to warn me that there had been another disaster. It was August, and Ian was on holiday and I was the forensic pathologist in charge of London and the southeast of England. At this stage, no one knew how many bodies there would be, but one thing was certain, there would be bodies. This time, catastrophe had occurred not on the railway, but on the River Thames. I waited for more news before setting off, and my first stop was the police pier in Wapping. A leisure boat had sunk somewhere near Southwark, and bodies recovered from the vessel were here. That was all I knew. An old police sergeant greeted me, and to my astonishment he was close to tears. "Almost got my 30 years in, Doc, and now there's 25 dead from the river, 24 on the boat, another one picked up this morning 8 bridges upstream at Vauxhall. Never thought I'd see anything like this. They're all kids. Kids in their 20s. So the boat that went down must have been one of those party vessels, the sort people hire to cruise up and down the Thames. I had seen them and heard them many times. Young people on the deck, clothes fluttering under the lights like giant moths, laughter and music discernible from either riverbank. Through the windows, the shadows, colours and movement of the dance floor. The sergeant added, "Doc, the police surgeon's already been in and certified them all dead." Now he really began to cry, walking away, shaking his head. I heard him blow his nose before opening the door and going back to the front desk to fend off the press. Wapping Police Pier is a Victorian police station standing right beside the river. At the back, an area had been designated the temporary mortuary. It was just a room, really. Its concrete floor was nearly covered by body bags. All of them lay open, and in each one lay the body of a young adult, all dressed for a party, many in bright colours. I looked across this devastating scene, and I noticed something strange. Their clothing had been disturbed. Dresses were displaced. Trousers opened. I immediately went back out to the sergeant. He grimaced. Police surgeon opened all the clothes, think he might have been checking what sex they were. I wasn't pleased, but there wasn't much I could do about it now. Probably they had been overwhelmed by events and had needed to feel that he was doing something, anything useful. Check pulses, listen for heartbeats. I'd seen this sort of reaction before. Even highly trained professionals want to do something when they know full well that the correct thing to do is absolutely nothing. I then went to Westminster. I knew the deceased wouldn't stay long in the temporary police mortuary. I wanted to ensure that Westminster mortuary was prepared for the large number of bodies that was about to hit them. Oh no, I remembered that the usual manager, Peter Bevan, was on holiday. His deputy was in charge, and I had never found this man to be anywhere near as organised or efficient as his boss. Peter's calm, capable, organisational skills were exactly what we needed when managing a mass disaster. However, at least the staff were busy preparing for the huge intake, and all the post-mortem tables and necessary equipment were ready. The sight of these preparations gave me, for the first time, a sense of dread that was something close to nausea. It was fleeting, but powerful. With another pathologist under my supervision, I agreed to return the next day when the bodies had been brought over from Wapping to start the examinations. Gradually the facts emerged. On that calm summer night, a huge dredger had collided on the Thames near Southwark Bridge with a small pleasure boat called the Marchioness. The Bow Bell had dumped its cargo of gravel at Nine Elms and was proceeding back out to sea to dredge for more. The Marchioness had been hired to celebrate a birthday, and an international crowd of young people was partying on board. Initially, the Bow Bell hit the little Marchioness at the back on the starboard side. This caused the pleasure boat to rock and keel over. A witness said the Bow Bell then mounted it, pushing it underwater like a toy boat. In fact, the anchor of the dredger cut right through the pleasure boat's upper deck before a second impact pushed the back of the Marchioness round to starboard, causing her to roll over. Here are some survivor statements. I felt a jolt, then I noticed the stern moving out in a starboard direction. I saw water come through the open window. I felt the boat keel over. I remember turning around to head towards the windows to escape as water started coming in. I knew the boat was going to go down. Within a matter of seconds, the lights went out. Everything was in darkness. I was then thrown forward by a wall of water. The whole boat filled instantly. When I surfaced, I was some distance away from the Marchioness, which was partly submerged. I felt the right-hand side of the boat dip down suddenly. As the boat tipped over, water came flooding in through those open windows on the right-hand side. Everybody who had been on the dance floor lost their footing, and with me and chairs and everything movable went sliding down to the right, down into the water which was filling the dance area incredibly fast. I went underwater. Suddenly the boat tilted onto its side and the toilet began to fill with water. I tried to unlock the door and get out. When I managed to get the door open, the boat was completely submerged. I felt the boat rock. Then it all of a sudden sort of swerved round and I lost my balance. I think I fell against the table. I saw this hull coming through the boat. I saw this anchor coming in. Glass started breaking. All the windows smashed and shattered with glass. Water started pouring in. A terrifying ordeal for the young people on board. All passengers' chances of escape were hampered by the great speed of the sudden rotation, loose furniture, darkness, the cold, turbid water, and for some, the lack of accessible emergency exits. The result was that, to get away, physical exertion and strength were required, which compromised the survival chances of many. A much later statement on the disaster made by Dr. Howard Oakley, an expert on survival and thermal medicine, said, "Sudden capsize is known to be a shocking experience, to which individual reactions would have varied from panic to calm determination to escape and survive. Physiological responses to that shock are likely to have shortened the time for which victims could hold their breath, which would in turn have reduced the chances of successful escape." Within 30 seconds of impact, the Marchioness was lying at the bottom of the Thames. 14 vessels helped to rescue the living, but not for several hours, at least, were the dead retrieved. Many of the dead were probably trapped on the boat. Others must have been thrown overboard. The Thames is a treacherous river, deep and dark, with a rich mixture of currents and tides, which are known to hide bodies for days and even weeks before giving them up. In fact, it was 5 hours before the first body from the Marchioness was found in the river, and almost 2 weeks until the Thames yielded the last one. A drowned body, or a body which is immersed in water after dying some other way, will first develop opaque, wrinkly skin. Anyone who has spent too long in the bath will have an idea what this looks like. It's often called washerwoman's hands. The thick keratin layers on the fingers, the palms and the soles become macerated, and the skin appears very white and wrinkled, whatever the ethnicity of the deceased. After a few days, if the body remains in the water, this macerated skin will begin to separate and it will eventually peel off. I should also say, because it is relevant to what happened next, that the time it takes a body to float to the surface depends on the gas in the bloated and decomposing body, generally the obese surface fastest. The Marchioness went down shortly before 2 a.m. on the morning of Sunday the 20th of August. By the end of that day, although I had, with a colleague from Guy's, viewed and organised the bodies, we still had no idea how many people on board had died. There were clearly a lot of survivors, so we were harbouring hopes that there might be few further bodies. By law, the coroner is in charge of those bodies, and Westminster's coroner, Paul Knapman, came back to London from his holiday in Devon and met with me and senior police officers to agree how we would process the dead. As coroner, he had to establish positive identification of the bodies, and we discussed how he wanted to do this. In mass disaster management, false identification is the biggest fear. This is obviously hideous for everyone, especially if a family later begins to suspect they may have buried the wrong body. The coroner rightly wanted the most secure and accurate identification methods that were possible. Now, we have the option of DNA analysis, but although the subject of much pub discussion, DNA identification was just not available to us then. The two most secure means were still fingerprints and comparison of teeth with dental records. The problem with dental records is that you, of course, have to know the name of the missing before you can begin to search for their dentist, and only when the name of the dentist is known can you request their records. And then that request can take a very long time to fulfill. This is especially true if records must come from other countries. And by now we knew that the partygoers on the Marchioness were a high-flying crowd from all over the world. That was clearly going to cause problems and delays. As a result of all this, fingerprinting was the first choice of identifier. Fingerprinting plus dental records would be ideal. Absolute accuracy can be a time-consuming business, but the coroner took the view that accuracy was more important than speed, which is surely correct, although I can understand this is very frustrating for anxious relatives. Those who are trying to cope with the possibility of sudden bereavement after a mass disaster often cannot understand why the relatives are not simply invited into the mortuary to walk through the lines of fatalities to claim their loved one. Many relatives of the Marchioness victims, believing that identification must be easy, did in fact suggest that if they could just be allowed into the mortuary, they could find their family member. I understand their need and their logic, but it's false, and it would have been utterly inhumane to allow this. People find it hard to believe that in mass disasters, visual identification is unreliable, especially so when death has been traumatic or the body has been immersed in water. But even the uninjured and undecomposed dead are often simply not recognizable to those who knew them as animated individuals. Without life, facial expression, movement, robbed of our essential selves, our bodies can look very different. And this is certainly the case when the dead have been held by the Thames for hours or days. The fact is that relatives, even immediate family, when they are under great stress, are very likely to make mistakes. They may identify a body that isn't their relative, or they may not correctly identify a body that really is their loved one. These are known as false positive or false negative identifications, and they happen more often than you might think. Later, perhaps much later, the identifying relatives sometimes worry they were wrong, and then change their minds. This can occur long after burial or cremation, when our ability to review the identification is lost. Add to the difficulties of identification, the immense emotional trauma of having to look at many, many bodies in the mortuary to find the one you think may be your relative. With all my experience of death and dying, I know I couldn't walk between rows of victims and reliably identify my own wife or child or parent. I should say that being called on to see a body for identification purposes is quite different from seeing that body once police and pathologists are sure that the correct identification has taken place. I personally believe every relative who wishes to do so has an absolute right to see the body of their deceased. It's cruel to deny it for whatever reason. A family this chance to say goodbye personally. But the reality is that bodies may be injured, decomposed and smelly. We can do a lot with reconstruction, but we can't perform miracles. So it may take many hours of talking and discussing, of initially showing photographs of the body before we can move into the room where the body lies. And there may be more time again before the relatives will actually look at the body. Spending this time with families is crucial. So is care and compassion. We must do nothing to add to the trauma. As unreliable as visual identification is the use of mobile or movable indicators, such as clothing, jewelry or wallets. These may be treated only as clues to identity because people swap jewelry or look after friends' wallets. And to use clothing, we would have needed to know exactly what the victims were wearing on the night of their death, relying on descriptions from others, when such descriptions are seldom either accurate or available. Despite this, the coroner was inclined to accept visual identification and mobile indicators, but only from those bodies recovered from the wreck of the Marchioness itself, and only as long as they showed no decomposition. In all other cases, the coroner instructed that mobile means of identification were not dependable. The coroner's conclusion, when we discussed identification, was that fingerprinting of each body was essential. As a list of the suspected missing was compiled, police were dispatched to homes, and thus they happened already to have fingerprints on their database, to collect personal items on which fingerprints might be found, so that these could be used to match those taken in the mortuary. Our problem was that these were drowned bodies. They were likely to be damaged, either by aquatic predators, or by contact with rocks, bridges, boats, or other underwater obstructions. Drowned bodies show all the discoloration and bloating of normal decomposition, plus some much earlier skin changes. Even if retrieved from the water within a few hours, those inevitable washerwoman hands can make fingerprinting difficult. And when there is a complete loss of skin from the hands, elegantly called degloving, well, then it can be extremely difficult or almost impossible to take fingerprints from the deeper layers of skin, the dermis. At first, this disaster seemed easier than Clapham because there was no severe mutilation of the bodies. As time went on, however, bodies arrived in worse and worse condition, and decomposition became our nemesis. Once again, each body travelled through a system. First, we described in detail clothes, jewellery and general appearance. I then helped remove the clothes and performed an external examination, describing tattoos, scars and anything unusual that might assist identification. Police officers made notes, and the body was photographed and refrigerated. The second phase was the full post-mortem, after which the internal organs would, as usual, be replaced in the body cavity and the body sewn up and made presentable for viewing by relatives. Finally, I submitted a report about each of the deceased for the coroner, concluding with the cause of death, drowning. If he was satisfied with all this, especially the identification processes, he would open an inquest and release the body. The first free-floating body was found in the Thames before 7 a.m. that Sunday morning. No more were found that day, but in the afternoon the Marchioness was raised, and when I reached Wapping Police Station, 24 had been found on board and arrived at Wapping in the warmth of an August day. They were tagged before being carried on to Westminster Mortuary. This mortuary is run by Westminster City Council. At that time, it had 6 holding fridges, refrigeration for 60 bodies, and a further 6 units for extra-wide bodies. It had freezing facilities for 18 bodies. Whatever the outside temperature, bodies are refrigerated to a temperature of 4 degrees centigrade. This slows down the decomposition process, but does not stop it completely. We do not freeze bodies until the post-mortem has been fully completed. During a disaster, we work in a world of constantly changing information, often helping to revise and then re-revise it. The key problem for those managing the Marchioness victims was that no one had any idea exactly how many people had been on board the boat, nor who they were. So within a couple of hours, while the rescue operation was still going on, and before the first body had been found near Vauxhall Bridge, a telephone bureau had been opened to process information from friends and relatives that might help us identify victims. And by that afternoon, as Westminster Mortuary prepared for its influx of dead, relatives of some on board had started to appear at police stations with photos of their loved ones and descriptions of what they might have been wearing. By the end of that first day, the police believed that there had been 150 people on the Marchioness, of whom 65, including those 24 bodies taken from the wreckage, were considered missing. The next day I was back at the mortuary starting a long process of identification and post-mortem. We learned that 87 survivors had identified themselves, and we had 25 bodies. So we knew that if police estimates of the number of people on board were correct, there were a lot more bodies to come. Expecting so many further arrivals, we worked as speedily as accuracy would allow. It was an extremely intense week. To see so many young people here was not just unusual, it was shocking. I was aware, as though in my peripheral vision, of the intense misery of parents fearing the worst, waiting for news. Bodies were laid out one at a time on the 6 tables in the post-mortem room, and we worked our way doggedly from one to the next, feeling the greatest service we could perform for the bereaved was to do our job as efficiently as possible. By 8 o'clock that evening, we had completed post-mortems on all 25 in the mortuary, and of these, 13 had now been fully identified. The next day, Tuesday the 22nd of August, we learned that the Casualty Bureau had received 4,725 calls from anxious relatives and had already amassed more than 2,000 documents on individuals believed to be on board. As we waited, a few more bodies were found in various places on the Thames, upstream and downstream of the disaster, and the police revised their estimate of the number of people on board the Marchioness down to 136. By the end of the day, there were 30 bodies in the mortuary and police thought there were 27 more to be found. But by now, immersion time in the Thames was taking its toll. Waterlogged skin was falling off fingers, and the officers were having trouble getting prints using the standard inking process. The coroner called for dental records to help confirm the identity of the remaining fatalities, but this would take time, and relatives were anxious for news. So attempts to fingerprint continued, but as the hours went by, conventional fingerprinting was failing. It was now necessary to use a specialist technique and more sophisticated equipment. This equipment was based in the laboratory in Southwark, which had no facilities to manage bodies. The routine process for individual bodies recovered from the Thames that could not be fingerprinted at the mortuary was to remove the hands, fingerprint them at the lab in Southwark, and then return the hands to the body. They were sewn back on to avoid distressing relatives who, when the body is appropriately arranged, were unlikely even to see the stitches. The coroner allowed this, and so the procedure was followed. 17 pairs of hands were removed. That evening, more bodies were found between Westminster and London Bridge, and then another, far downstream past Wapping. The next day, 8 more bodies were found. One, retrieved at Cherry Garden Pier on the south side of the river at Bermondsey, was wearing uniform and strongly suspected to be the Marchioness's captain, Stephen Faldo. Another was nearby. Then 4 more were found near HMS Belfast, not far from London Bridge. 2 more were on the other side of the wreckage, upstream around Westminster. That gave us a total of 44 bodies. By now we had positively identified 24 of these. Of course, there was an assumption that every single body found on the river must be from the Marchioness. But this was unlikely to be the case. There are suicides and other deaths in the Thames almost weekly, and we had to be aware of this. By the following day, there were 48 bodies, and although we had been working as hard as we could, 6 were still waiting for postmortems. The police were saying they now believe there had been 140 people on board the Marchioness, 84 survivors and 56 lost or missing. The dental records of all the known victims had been requested, those from abroad via the relevant embassies. That night, Wednesday, the Casualty Bureau closed, saying it had gathered all the information about the missing it could. However, bodies were still being found, and the police revised their estimates again. They thought there were 83 survivors and 56 lost or missing. But there was now a report, for the first time, of a 54-year-old woman running the disco on the boat. This was followed by another report of a woman jumping into the Thames near HMS Belfast after a handbag full of bricks was found on the riverbank. As we carried out our postmortems, some officers began to grumble at the way the Casualty Bureau had closed when so many inquiries were still outstanding. And by Thursday evening, there was a new development that pushed police estimates of the number of people on board up again. A group of gatecrashers at the party came forward to say they had survived the sinking, but a friend was missing. Meanwhile, back at the mortuary, a request was sent to the lab for the return of the 17 pairs of hands as soon as possible, so that they could be reunited with their owners. Another 8 pairs of hands were delivered to the lab. There was not much more we could do now but wait. It was the Friday before the August bank holiday. Outside the mortuary, people were leaving hot London for the weekend. We were waiting for dental records to arrive, fingerprint information from the labs, or just more bodies. 50 had now been recovered. After all that frantic activity, the mortuary seemed almost eerily quiet. No new bodies arrived in the mortuary over the long weekend. On the Wednesday, the police attempted to name the people still missing. One of them was the party's host, Antonio Vasconcelos, who had been celebrating his 26th birthday. Another was a Frenchman. And there was still one unidentified body in the mortuary, a man in his 20s. He may have been nothing to do with the Marchioness, or he could be the gatecrasher, who had still not been named. By the end of the week, 46 of the 50 bodies in the mortuary had been positively identified, and the others partially identified, meaning that we still needed more information to make it positive. Except for this one anonymous young man. Who was he? Nobody had any idea. He fitted no description. Since he was carrying a distinctive key fob, the police photographed it and decided to release the picture to the press. So we had one person completely unidentified and still two missing people, the Frenchman and Antonio Vasconcelos. We could stop worrying about the gate crasher, though. He had shown up alive and well. On Friday, there was a major step forward in the identification of the mystery man. The distinctive key fob was taken to the Frenchman's flat, and it opened the door there. Now only the party host was missing. That night, the body of a young man was found downstream of the wreck, between London Bridge and Bermondsey, somewhere in that area broadly known as the Thames Upper Pool. We were fairly confident this was Antonio Vasconcelos, but after 2 weeks in the water, we knew it would take some time to identify him positively. We were also confident that the other bodies in the mortuary had nothing to do with the Marchioness, and the police were sure now that there were no more dead. The toll was 51, and there had been 137 people on board. We had worked hard, and I felt had served the victims and their families well. Only afterwards did I understand that, while I had been immersed in my work at the mortuary, a lot more was happening inside and outside it than I realized. Everyone responds rapidly and wholeheartedly to an emergency. Everyone does their best at the time. So although everyone, no matter how well-meaning, should be held to account, it is hard to receive criticism afterwards for actions that may have been taken under extreme pressure in a crisis. The emergency and follow-up services, after many of the 1980s disasters I listed earlier, frequently found themselves on the receiving end of some very angry criticism. It is such anger that very often fuels reform. This is nowhere more true than after the sinking of the Marchioness. I learnt that although some relatives early on identified their dead at a special viewing room at the mortuary, many others were told, due to late recovery of the body and the extent of the decomposition, they could not, they were not allowed to, see their loved ones. Sad reunions of the living and the dead do not usually take place at the mortuary. More often the body is moved to the undertakers first. But undertakers, as well as the police, later claimed they had been told such viewings should be strongly discouraged, and even, in the face of opposition, relatives should be refused access to the dead. I do not know who ordered this or why. When I learned of it, I assumed it was the result of misplaced compassion, because someone thought that seeing a son or daughter in a state of decomposition is traumatic. However, that person clearly did not know that not seeing them is even worse. One relative later wrote, "We were never actually prohibited from seeing our daughter, but were talked out of doing so at every stage. When I went to the undertakers expecting to see her, the coffin was already sealed. I could not sit in a room with a box, and so walked out of the funeral parlour. I feel very strongly that I should have had the opportunity of time alone with her." Her mother has since seen photographs of our daughter, and from the photographs, there really is no reason why we should not have seen her. Another wrote, "On Friday the 25th of August, I was told by the coroner's officer that my son was not recognisable as a human being. On Thursday the 31st of August, the undertaker phoned me to say they had collected his body. I went immediately to their premises and asked for the coffin to be opened. I wanted to make sure that I had found my son. The undertaker told me that he had been given orders not to let me view my son's body. This made me extremely upset. I was never given the opportunity to see him, to touch him, and to say goodbye to him. The undertaker told me that he had been an undertaker for 25 years, and he had never before been told that relatives could not view a body. I was told the coffin was sealed and it must be kept sealed, he said. Since it is the undertakers who place a body in its coffin, and they are the ones to close it, this was clearly untrue. I still worry whether it is in fact my son who we buried. I think the root of this concern is that I was never allowed to see him. There is an additional concern that the bodies may have got mixed up. Later, I looked at photos of his body. They were far less horrific than I had expected. I could not help feeling ill at ease with how things had been arranged. My concerns about whether I was ever given his body have meant that I have, in the past, sought an exhumation order. I had no idea why the relatives of the Marchioness victims had been denied access to their loved ones, This seemed a cruel and unnecessary decision. It was to be a few more years before further information emerged to offer us, the relatives and those of us who had worked on the case, a possible reason why bodies were not seen and coffins not opened. Chapter 23. Early autumn, 1992. Jen was now a doctor. She had graduated the previous year, and we had gone to her results night disco at the medical school bar, where I, at least, had felt rather geriatric, and then decided to enjoy the dancing. I was ridiculously proud of Jen, but probably didn't show it. And maybe she was grateful to me for the support, the children, the house, the bills, but she didn't show that either. How hard it was to cross whatever chasm lay between us. It was much easier to ignore it, especially now that she was a junior doctor, working all hours, and I was so busy at Guy's. Today, for once, I was working from home, children at school, nanny off, Jen at the hospital. The daytime streets were quiet, much quieter than the office. The room was comfortably warm, a dog flopped on each of my feet, and the desk was littered with pictures of a homicide in which I was completely engrossed. On top of the post-mortem pictures and a book of photographs of the victim's clothes were the scene of crime photos. I could not forget that rather grey July day, the urban wilderness of a large South London park, a path heavy with tree shade, lightened by the trunks of silver birches, the "Police Do Not Cross" tape wound from tree to tree. I saw something white in the grass among the trees, which from a distance you could mistake for a discarded handkerchief. As I neared the handkerchief, a detective on either side of me, it grew larger and became more dissonant with its surroundings, until by the time I arrived, the contrast screamed between this green place and the human body which lay, blanched, mostly naked, below shimmering birch leaves. A young woman, curled defensively, stabbed many times, her lower body naked, sexually assaulted. I waited for the police photographers to finish their work before I took a temperature and a few early swabs for semen. I felt her for rigor mortis and found that only her jaw had set. Then I examined the scene, looking at places where the ground had been disturbed, the detectives pointing out the bloodstains on the grass, noting crushed leaves and broken branches where there were signs of a struggle. This all took many hours. The body was at last removed to the mortuary, where, watched by the same grave detectives, I performed the post-mortem. In the comfort of my study now, I remembered that long, long night. How it was dawn before every one of the 49 stab wounds had been measured and documented, each track traced through the internal organs it had penetrated. I looked up. The clock ticked in the quiet house. I reached for the post-mortem report and reread the conclusion. No natural cause had contributed to the victim's death. She had died of multiple deep stab wounds, inflicted by a knife or knives about 9 centimeters long, about 1.5 centimeters wide at the hilt. She had struggled and had been stabbed right through her left hand as she tried to defend herself. Once she was dead, her assailant had not stopped stabbing her, and once she was dead, he sexually assaulted her. There was immense public horror at Rachel Nickell's brutal murder. She was a beautiful, 23-year-old mother who had taken her toddler to Wimbledon Common for a walk. The nation's shock put pressure on the police to solve this crime, and solve it soon. So immense was this pressure that the Met stepped outside its usual box. Officers talked to forensic psychologists about profiling the killer, and they talked to me about reconstructing the case. I had all but given up hope of playing my part in a police investigation, ever since my first careful recreation of a crime, that bedroom knife murder, was spurned by the case detective. And now, for once, the police had come to me and asked for a reconstruction. Specifically, they wanted me to piece together the likely sequence of events that day, based on the evidence present at the scene and at my post-mortem findings. I had recently been inspired by a convention of American forensic pathologists I had attended. For a while now I'd felt that, as a profession, forensic pathology wasn't developing much. We all rushed around on our cases and discussed them in the pub, but that isn't the same as development of ourselves or of our profession. I went to American conventions for a different perspective. And recently I'd found just that, when I had learned that American pathologists were now encouraged to be a bit more Simpsonish by participating in the investigation. So I read through my own very thick post-mortem report on Rach and Nikhil. The wound details went on for pages. Three wounds, on the chest and back, which I'd numbered 17, 41 and 42, stood out from the rest. They were the only superficial wounds in the victim who had been stabbed deeply over and over again. Could these have been the first? There is a moment at the very beginning of the chain of events which leads to a homicide such as this, when the perpetrator has to get close enough to his victim to gain control. We know that establishing control is a particularly important part of most sexual homicides. In such cases, we often find wounds that are not deep enough to injure, but scary enough to make a victim comply with an assailant's demands. These are prodding wounds. Were 17, 41 and 42 prodding wounds? There was just one on the deceased's back, number 17, while the others were high at the front of her chest. I looked at them again. I wondered if she was first prodded in the back, and then did she turn to face her assailant. In the scene of crime pictures, the most significant bloodstains were easy to discern. They were not under trees, but in a place where the summer grass was left long and full of seeds like a meadow. This was about 5 meters from the place the body was discovered in the late afternoon by a shocked mother with a toddler, dog and pushchair. There was a second, smaller area of staining, much closer to the body's final position. It was adjacent to the forked birch tree under which the dead woman was found. And of course, there were bloodstains beneath the body. It was safe to assume that the initial assault had taken place at the bloodiest site, that the victim had been moved to the spot under the tree and then pulled a meter into that final position nearby. Looking at the endless list of wounds, it was hard to decide which came first, but the gaping neck wounds must have happened fairly early on, as they would have produced the most blood. That would also explain why the victim apparently did not scream. Her neck had been attacked with force, and the pain would have been extreme. If that didn't stop her screaming, then the resulting damage to the muscles around her larynx would have done so. The pictures of Rachel Nikhil's clothes told me another part of the story. Her t-shirt was wet with blood, of course, but her jeans, around and below the knee, were muddy at the front and blood spattered at the back. I was absolutely sure this could only be because she was kneeling early on in the assault while the initial injuries to her neck were inflicted. Of course, with such injuries, she could not have remained kneeling. She must have fallen. It seemed likely she had fallen forward and that her assailant had now stabbed her back 18 times in all. Whichever way she fell, but especially if she fell forwards, her neck would have bled profusely onto the ground. Is that why the killer moved her to the second area under the tree? Or did he do this because by now she had died? Or because he feared he could be seen too easily here on the grass? The pictures showed less blood under the tree, but the distribution was wider. That is probably an indication she was lying here prone. I checked the pictures of her body at post-mortem. Yes, leaf mould on her back. This must indeed have been where he stabbed her front. If she was not dead when he moved her, she must have died very soon after. Even so, he continued to stab her body. In particular, he stabbed the heart and liver post-mortem. They were penetrated, but the dead do not bleed. Next, I noticed that the leaf mould on her back was also visible on her buttocks. So here, under the tree, he must have ripped off her jeans. And during or after this, her body was pulled over to be sexually assaulted in its final compliant position. Did he continue to stab her afterwards, or did he run off at once? In my opinion, the minimum length of time needed to inflict all the injuries would be 3 minutes, said my post-mortem report. I knew that because, as usual, I had reenacted the moves here at home. If the murder had taken only 3 minutes, it certainly must have been fast and furious, and it gave every appearance of a frenzied attack. Even the coroner himself used this expression, and the newspapers had certainly not been able to resist it. I had also spent hours analysing the knife wounds, some of which showed evidence of the weapon's square hilt on the skin because the blade had been plunged in up to its maximum depth. And for the first time,